طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We are hearing more and more lately about the so-called shifting Palestinian narrative. Today, two speakers from the Palestinian human rights organization, Al-Shabaka, explore the depth and breadth of the process and the meaning of the shifting narrative in the era of intersectionality. Here are Al-Shabaka's commissioning editor, Nadeem Pawalsa, board president Tariq Bakhouni, and senior analyst Yara Hawari speaking at one of their policy forums.
But good evening and welcome to the first of Al-Shabaka's policy labs in 2022. Thank you for being with us tonight. My name is Nadeem Bawalsa. I'm the commissioning editor at Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and I'm honored to be with you tonight facilitating this important discussion about the globally shifting narratives around Palestine. From the COVID-19 pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement to the 2021 Palestinian Unity Intifada, events that have unfolded on the global stage over the past 2 years have significantly impacted our daily realities. Today, the Palestinian struggle exists in a world of greater connectivity, one where movements for justice are transcending state structures and institutions. People everywhere are recognizing the pervasiveness and interconnectedness of systems of oppression and are forging expansive solidarities and alliances. As Al-Shabaka enters its 12th year, we consider the importance of understanding and presenting Palestine in light of these shifts, as well as the transnational, regional, and local developments shaping our world order. This is of particular relevance after the Unity Intifada, which continues to have major local implications and which continues to shift the global conversation on Palestine in significant ways. We witnessed this most recently in coverage of Israel's ethnic cleansing campaigns in the Naqab and its ongoing campaigns in Sheikh Jarrah. What exactly are these narrative shifts? How did they come about and where are they headed? Who is driving them and who is opposing them? When it comes to Al-Shabaka, how can our analysis incorporate and contribute to these shifts, whether on the streets, on social media platforms, or in the halls of power? And in highlighting the interconnectedness of oppressed communities worldwide, how can we simultaneously center the voices of Palestinians? In the first policy lab of 2022, I am joined by Al-Shabaka's senior analyst, Yara Hawari, and the organization's new board president, Tariq Bakhouni, to reflect on these questions and more. Dr. Tariq Bakhouni is board president of Al-Shabaka. He was Al-Shabaka's U.S. policy fellow from 2016 to 2017. Tariq is the former senior analyst for Israel-Palestine and economics of conflict at the International Crisis Group based in Ramallah, and he is the author of Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance. Tariq's writing has appeared in the London Review of Books, the New York Review of Books, and the Washington Post, among others. And he is a frequent commentator in regional and international media. He is also the book review editor for the Journal of Palestine Studies. Dr. Yara Hawari is the senior analyst at Al-Shabaka. She completed her PhD in Middle East politics at the University of Exeter, where she taught various undergraduate courses and continues to be an honorary research fellow. In addition to her academic work, which focused on indigenous studies and oral history, she is a frequent political commentator writing for various media outlets, including The Guardian, Foreign Policy, and Al Jazeera English. She is also author of The Stone House, released in December 2021, Mabruk, a gripping novella that explores the power of intergenerational trauma in Palestine. Thank you both for being with us tonight. So let's get right to it. So I'd like to ask you both the same questions. The first is about the narrative shifts themselves. Yara, let's begin with you. How would you define this global narrative shift around Palestine? Why and when would you say it took shape? What does it look like now?
Thanks, Nadeem, for starting us off with that question. I think the global narrative on Palestine is constantly shifting. And it's not a hegemonic thing. It differs across geographies, across communities, classes, etc. And so I think it really can be quite a difficult thing to measure and analyze. And to talk in generalizations can sometimes be misleading. So I think we have to be clear about narrative. What are we talking about? Where is it coming from? Are we talking about the grassroots, the policy level, the global south, Europe, the US, etc.? And I think even putting those in categories are generalizations in themselves. So it's definitely not an easy topic to address, but I think me and Sadiq will endeavor to do our best. And I think it's important to start by saying that the mainstream global media, the sort of the policy narrative on Palestine, has for a long time not been shaped by Palestinians themselves, but rather by much more powerful actors. And I'm sure many of us know Edward Said's seminal piece, Permission to Narrate, where he talks about this at length in the context of the Israeli invasion of Beirut in 1982. And Palestinians haven't been passive when it comes to trying to shape this narrative. You know, they've done so through different means over many different decades. Indeed, the PLO played a huge role in this, not only in the 60s and 70s through their research and archive efforts, but also as a representative body itself. It insisted on the recognition of the Palestinian people, where previously we had been dismissed as simply a refugee problem. But let's fast forward to the current state of affairs. And if we look briefly at the US policy level, for example, the narrative on Palestine isn't that great, which I think is probably the understatement of the year. The Trump administration was probably the most crude manifestation of that, with many arguing that he had crossed all of these red lines that had never been crossed before. And so you'll find many liberals saying that, you know, the Biden administration is at least a welcome relief vis-a-vis Palestine. But I think it would be actually much fairer to argue that the Trump administration was actually following a cross-party US line on Palestine. It was just much more honest in their blatant disregard of Palestinian rights and aspirations of sovereignty. And we only have to look at the Obama administration, which, for example, vetoed a UNSC resolution declaring settlements illegal in 2011, among many other things. And this was also an administration which consistently avoided using legal language when talking about the issue, using the argument that international law does not advance peace or diplomatic efforts. Now, the European policy level across the pond is also pretty dire. And I think it's gotten a lot worse. And I think that's partially related to the general weakening of the European Union and the rise of certain Eastern European blocs, which have very pro-Zionist tendencies. And it's different to that of the US that, you know, the rhetoric still tends to be very much rooted in international law, very timidly so. And always without any kind of, you know, oomph. So we see statements of concern, you know, things like that may have been a breach of international law. And of course, this narrative anyway has no real action behind it. So I think I want to switch gears a little and also focus on something which is a bit more uplifting, and that is the Palestinian and international grassroots in its various geographies and how they are actually shifting the narrative within their movements, within their social justice struggles, and how also this is influencing mainstream media spaces. Now, the Palestinian struggle is being put back into that framework of internationalism and intersectionality. And the lexicon around Palestine is widening. You know, people in these spaces are beginning to understand Palestine in a much more holistic manner. It's no longer just about the West Bank and Gaza. And I think this is very much linked to the developments on the Palestinian street, which has been insisting on this understanding of Palestine. Let's go briefly back to the Unity Intifada of May 2021, which insisted that Sheikh Jarrah, the neighborhood in Jerusalem facing aggressive ethnic cleansing, wasn't an isolated case. Rather, it encapsulated, and it continues to encapsulate, the common Palestinian experience of dispossession. And at that time, and until today, Palestinians saw their own experiences, that of their parents and grandparents, in the imminent expulsion of the Sheikh Jarrah families. And the narrative of the uprising soon evolved into one that addressed the larger struggle against the fragmentation of the Palestinian people, not just that of dispossession. And that's why it became known as the Intifada of Unity, the Unity Intifada. Now, I remember at the time, foreign pundits and media outlets were really keen to draw connections with the Arab revolutions that happened over a decade ago. And indeed, similar conclusions were drawn as they were then, that the Unity Intifada was this spontaneous outburst. And many and much of the analysis failed to tie the fragments and communities together. You know, the notion that Palestinians in Gaza, in Haifa, in Jerusalem were mobilizing under shared struggle was lost on many. And the demonstrations in the 48 territories were characterized as intercommunal strife between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs, rather than indigenous resistance against settler colonial domination. And yet the aesthetics were very clear. You know, here we have Palestinians in Haifa, in Yaffa, and beyond, marching with Palestinian flags and chanting Palestinian chants. Now, something else that was particularly significant about this moment was that on mainstream media, we were seeing young, non-Palestinian Authority-affiliated Palestinians articulating this narrative. And really, I think for the first time in our history, we were seeing and hearing the words of apartheid, of settler colonialism on mainstream news outlets repeatedly in the span of a couple of weeks. And I think it's important to end on this, that the Unity Intifada isn't over. This narrative of fighting against fragmentation isn't over. Today in the Naqab, also commonly known in English as the Negev, Palestinians are rising up against mass displacement, against land theft. And meanwhile, Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah, in Jerusalem, are still struggling and fighting to stay in their homes. And these aren't separate events. And Palestinians are insisting that these aren't separate events, that they are continuous and part of the same mechanism. And I think that's something that the Palestinian street is really hammering home to the mainstream narratives.
Thank you, Yara, especially for reminding our viewers that the Intifada is not over. And in fact, it hasn't ended just because there may have been less coverage following the atrocities in May and June of last year. Tarek, I turn to you with the same question. Can you tell us about your thoughts and analysis and your assessment of these narrative shifts around Palestine?
Thank you, Nadim. Yara laid out a lot of the thinking that I've been doing around these issues beautifully. I want to add a few points that hopefully will complement what she said. I'm really glad that Yara brought up the issue or the episode of the Arab revolutions that began a decade ago. I recall at the time, a lot of commentators and analysts began asking questions like, when is the Palestinian Spring happening? And why is the Palestinian Spring lagging behind? There are all these revolutions that are happening in the region and the Palestinians are not mobilizing. Fast forward about a decade, and what we're seeing today is an example of another kind of infusion into the narrative. We see commentators and analysts talking about the racial justice movements, talking about the George Floyd moment in Palestine, thinking about ways in which they can place that kind of global narrative or even regional narrative onto Palestine. And I think while it's important to understand that Palestine is part of the region, and yes, it was an important question to understand when revolutions might happen in Palestine. And similarly, in this moment in time, racial structures of oppression are very much present in Palestine, and it makes sense to ask about how BLM manifests in Palestine. At the same time, the fact that these episodes show that the question of Palestine keeps getting informed by local and regional and international narratives shows that it's actually really important for us to go back into the Palestinian narrative itself and to ground that narrative, how we talk and how we think about Palestine, in the local context of what's happening on the ground and what's unfolding on the ground. So while we're thinking and understanding the world to be a different stage and the region to be a different region, and understanding how the struggle for Palestinian rights is unfolding in that broader ecosystem, it is really always important to go back to basics. And here I want to try to articulate a couple of points that I think are really important for us to think about when we're talking about a narrative shift. The first has to do with this idea that I think got floated around last year, which was a very important development, which is that finally the apartheid framework is breaking into the mainstream. This was picked up by the international media after reports by B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, and Human Rights Watch. And it was seen as a breakthrough that this kind of rhetoric was finally entering into the mainstream establishment. And it was further reinforced, as Yara said, by the idea that the Unity Intifada showed and demonstrated the singular aspect of the Palestinian people. So Palestinian peoplehood rising in their different constituencies against a single regime. Now, that breakthrough happened in 2021. In 1965, before the Israeli occupation of the occupied territories had even begun, Palestinian intellectual Faiz al-Sayer had already designated Israel an apartheid regime. So we're talking about a delay of 40 or 50 years when thinking about how the Palestinian narrative, divorced from the regional and international narratives that shape it, was already defining and understanding what its struggle was, and how long it's taken that narrative to break into the mainstream, as Yara said, because of the gatekeeping that happened and continues to happen in mainstream media establishments and often also among policymakers. So I think that is an example of the necessity of actually centering Palestinian voices in how they analyze the Palestinian struggle and rooting the narrative of the Palestinian struggle for self-determination in Palestine itself, even as it remains in conversation with developments and trends that are happening locally and regionally. So I think that's one important takeaway from this. The second, and I think Yara began to touch on this, but I'll further expand, is that there are divisions in even the Palestinian narrative. At the time when the grassroots are mobilizing around the Unity Intifada, we're understanding internationally that there is a greater recognition of the fact that Palestinians are facing an apartheid regime. We have a leadership that's committed to a narrative that is falling far short of the basic rights that Palestinians as a people are demanding. And that narrative has diplomatic power by virtue of the fact that it is given forward by the recognition of the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinian people. And this shows the importance of understanding how to decipher the narratives and to understand who's saying what and for what reason. The Palestinian leadership's commitment to a particular narrative has, rather than leading to liberation, created a situation where the only possible outcome for the Palestinian leadership is to remain committed to the status quo and to further entrench a system of domination that is denying Palestinians their basic rights. So even though the Palestinian leadership might be putting forward a certain narrative, we need to understand the underlying structural realities that have put forth that narrative and make room for alternative narratives which are emerging most clearly from the grassroots in instances like the Unity Intifada, which are building on a longer history of Palestinian liberation and decolonization that continues to inform their struggle. One other, and I'll probably end on this point, which is to highlight something that is that has been quite astounding to witness over the course of the past year, possibly longer since the beginning of COVID, and that is the power of the social justice movements to emerge globally in a way that is intersectional and in a way that is bringing and strengthening the powers of different marginalized constituencies against systems of oppression. And even though these have local manifestations, and I'll reiterate this, the manifestation in Palestine needs to be specific to Palestine, there has been globally a very clear shift in terms of making room for non-state actors, for making room for narratives from below that has forced, I think, both policymakers and the media establishment to take note of narratives that might otherwise had been ignored. So what we saw last year was not only a breakthrough of Palestinians into mainstream establishments, but an appetite by the media to bring on Palestinians. Now, I don't want to overestimate this shift, because even when Palestinians are brought, they are often edited, their language is often controlled, they're often portrayed in a certain light that undermines the narrative that they're seeking to put forward. But nonetheless, there was a clear shift in the center of power, in the sense that grassroots mobilizations and intersectional struggles were no longer seen as only theoretical ideas that existed on the outside of the policymaking world. There was a demand for these movements to begin to be taken seriously within the centers of power. And in that sense, I think that the Palestinians are now on much firmer footing, because as a people facing an asymmetric struggle against a state that has diplomatic and military and economic power, that kind of backing from different constituencies, intersectional constituencies globally, becomes something that is very important for their struggle for decolonization. And just as an example on this, the ability of Palestinians, for example, in Australia to mobilize and boycott the Sydney Film Festival through working with indigenous communities and other communities that are marginalized, in order to boycott the Sydney Film Festival, which had taken support from the Israeli government, becomes a case in point.
Got it. Thank you so much. You bring up so many important points. I'd like us to get maybe to the notion of the importance of intersectionality and youth activism and social media and all of this that's coming up in the Q&A as we speak during the latter half of the lab. But I want to get back to this point about the schism or the rift that you point out is actually quite stark and significant when it comes to talking about where exactly is this narrative shift taking place, and what is the connection between Palestinians on the ground, between the grassroots level and the popular level, and their leadership, given that their leadership is as you said, falling short of fulfilling or promoting this narrative shift. Yara, as our senior analyst, what we really are getting at here is the political implications of these narrative shifts. Do you see that the narrative shift has impacted policy? If not yet, when?
And I think that's a really good question. You know, I see the impact on policymakers and diplomats on a very private level. And I think there is the heightened understanding into the situation and a recognition of what's happening here in Palestine as something that is very much apartheid. But unfortunately, that doesn't translate into action and challenging the status quo. And it's an incredibly frustrating reality that these diplomats and politicians will be very candid and say, yes, this is apartheid, this is ethnic cleansing. We see it with our own eyes, but we can't say anything publicly. or that it's pointless because of their capital positions, their country positions. And I think this was, you know, the ridiculousness of this was really epitomized in the theatrics of what happened in Sheikh Jarrah by the theatrics of the international diplomatic community when the Sahliya family home was being demolished. Now, this family home is exactly opposite the British Consulate General, and it's amongst many other diplomatic residences. And this family were literally being ripped from their homes. And these diplomats expressed, you know, public statements of concern at the forced displacement, and they posted pictures of themselves at the site of ethnic cleansing on social media. And I think that really epitomizes the state of affairs that we're in now vis-a-vis policy. So unfortunately, I think it's, you know, it's really an uphill battle. I don't think it's a lost cause. But I think what this means is that there needs to be really global geopolitical shifts. It's not about changing one politician's point of view or convincing a visiting diplomatic delegation that things here are really that bad, although I do think it's worth some energy in doing that. But I think we have to put the emphasis on shifting global geopolitics, because individuals, singular states, singular organizations coming out in support of Palestine is not a strong strategy. We need blocks of countries. We need blocks of organizations. And I do think there are glimmers of hope globally. You know, for example, the election of Gabriel Boric in Chile, which hopefully not only will usher in an end to neoliberalism in Chile, but he's also an outwardly big supporter of the Palestinian struggle. Now, of course, he or Chile alone can't do anything, but the more countries that elect leaders that are progressive, that have a strong position on Palestine, the more places that shift their own local politics, I think the more hope there is for Palestine. And so I do think that kind of policy work is important, but I think it needs to be contextualized in a wider, broader internationalist scope.
Thank you, Yara. Same question to you. How, if at all, do you believe the policy world has shifted given the narrative shifts we've been discussing?
Thank you, Nadeem. So I'm going to make three points here, and I think that builds on what Yara said as well, and hopefully gives us important things to think about. The first is when we're highlighting narrative shifts, the sad reality of the world we're living in is that these narrative shifts do not constitute change. The only thing that creates change is power. And even though, you know, we now think about Black Lives Matter as a movement that's created, for example, change and shifted the narrative in how we talk about racism, the reality is that white supremacy and structural racism is very much alive and well in the U.S. And that even Black Lives Matter has limits in terms of what it can point to in terms of actual change in the quality of life of African Americans or other minorities in the U.S. And so when we're thinking about narratives, it's really important to understand the power of narratives, because that's a prerequisite, of course, to explore what a future world of justice and liberation looks like, but not to overplay the impact of these narrative shifts. And I think when Palestinians, for example, after the Unity Intifada are celebrating the fact that they are overcoming the fragmentation that Israel has imposed on them and mobilizing as a single people, that's very important in terms of the narrative and in terms of its grassroots mobilization and potential. That's yet to translate into power. And the biggest challenge I think that Palestinians have ahead of them is to build on that power. And this is where the social justice movements, transnational movements, the kinds of solidarities and alliances that can be built becomes very important. So that's sort of the first point that I want to make. The second is that, and this is sort of related to the first, is policy on issues. Let's start with Palestine specifically. Policies on Palestine have not yet moved in the way that they need to be moving. What there is a shift that's happening on the policy level. And I think of it as a moment of flux. I think the policymaking community is coming out of the slumber of the past three decades, which is its thinking that the Oslo paradigm is going to produce a just two-state solution. And there is, I'd say over the past 5 years, I'd noted through my work, a very clear recognition and almost acceptance that off-the-shelf mantra that they continue to use publicly today is ineffective. And that is not actually the way forward for a just resolution. But what the way forward looks like is still unclear. So most policymakers tend to be frozen in this moment of time of recognizing that their policies are quite vacuous, but not understanding where they need to go from here. And I think one of the sort of minor shifts that we're starting to see is that there are efforts nowhere near where they need to be, but a slight effort to try to begin opening up space for alternatives to emerge in terms of, so we'd hear, for example, language that says two-state solution, but with equal rights. Now, the two things are obviously in conflict because there can't be a two-state solution that provides justice without the return of Palestinians to their homes in what is now Israel. And so there are tensions in the policymaking community that the policymakers are still trying to grapple with, but there is, I discern an effort to try to create room for alternatives. Those are the cracks that Palestinians need to push and push open more and more strategically. The third point I want to make, and that's my final point, is around, this is also related to the idea of power. When we're thinking about the narrative, it's really important for Palestinians to understand that actually their narrative, even though it's in conversation with all of these global narratives but while being sort of specific to Palestine, is also a narrative that's regional. Many of the demands that Palestinians are hoping for and calling for, including to live in dignity and to end authoritarianism, given that now the Palestinian leadership itself is an authoritarian body, are also desires and hopes that people in the region are articulating. And so when we're thinking of Palestine, it's really important to place it in its regional and geographic context and understand actually that there is power in seeing the struggle for Palestinian liberation as being a struggle that people in the region are sharing, and vice versa, that democratization and anti-authoritarian movements in the region also strengthens the Palestinian struggle for liberation. And so thinking in terms of how these narratives, which we sort of bandy about as just discourse without thinking about the political realities that they might be that they might carry within them, is to our detriment. I think thinking about that kind of political infrastructure that's underpinning these narratives is really important.
Got it. Thank you so much. Thank you both. I do have a final question, but I want to push it to the end. And that has more to do with sort of institutional goals and strategies moving forward for us at Al Shabaka. I want to get to some of these questions from the audience because they're so rich and to the point. In fact, one question that was just submitted, Abtari, you answered this in speaking about Palestinians looking regionally for sources of power. I certainly believe that I certainly agree, being in Jordan myself, that this is that it is palpable, and it is despite limitations here as well. But there is a way for Palestinians to sort of seize on this on what is a narrative shift regionally as well. But one of our audience members is asking, where do you locate the possible source of power? And I would add within Palestine, if the Palestinian street is being so oppressed.
I think it's a really good question. I mean, I think that the Unity Intifada, I want to sort of actually answer it from the regional perspective and then the Palestinian perspective. The Arab revolutions, for the most part, failed to produce actual democratic outcomes and economic opportunities that allow people in the region to live in dignity. That is not to say they weren't powerful. The revolutions that happened in the region managed to create room for the masses living in the region today to imagine a future that they could not have imagined before the revolutions. Before the revolution, there was the sense that the dictators are here to stay and that it's just impossible to think of alternatives. And the Arab revolutions shattered a kind of internalized resignation to the status quo. Even though they failed to build on the power of removing dictators like Mubarak and create alternatives, they showed and demonstrated the power of movements to create that kind of temporary change at the very top, not sufficient enough to dislodge the deep state. And now many would argue that the counter-revolution is more hegemonic and more powerful and more entrenched. But the shattering of the psyche of believing that there can be an alternative is something that I believe we have not seen the end of. And in that sense, I think that demonstrates a certain power on the popular level to mobilize. Now, the same can be said about the Unity Intifada. The Israeli settler colonization is ongoing. It's happening today in the Naqab. It's happening in East Jerusalem. Settler violence is expanding exponentially against Palestinians in the occupied territories. Palestinians who mobilized in the Unity Intifada are imprisoned in PA jails or in Israeli jails inside 48. That's not to say that the Unity Intifada has failed. That is to say that the Unity Intifada succeeded in showing us the power of mobilization to unify, even for a moment, overcoming the fragmentation that Palestinians had been living under is already a victory. It's a psychological liberation that is needed in every individual before actual liberation can be achieved. So I think when I'm thinking about power, I'm not thinking about it necessarily in the short-term context. I'm thinking about it in the context of long-term cycles of history that are needed to change realities and to effectively decolonize, to effectively democratize, to effectively mobilize. And that, I think, is a process that's ongoing. I mean, the power of people in the region hasn't subsided. It's clear. It intermittently resurfaces. We see that in Sudan. We see that in Tunis. And it's the same in Palestine. Every decade, there's an intifada and there's a massive eruption of mobilization that's challenging the status quo. I think our struggle, and maybe here we'll talk about that at the end, Nadim, when we're thinking about the Shabaka, organizations like a Shabaka, but the various other organizations that are active in the Palestinian ecosystem, this is the work that they need to be doing in terms of how do we build on this kind of mobilization, on these narrative shifts to develop power. And I just want to use as an example, the first example I gave, of and this is naming one Palestinian intellectual, Faiz al-Sayegh, talked about apartheid in 1965. And it's 2021 that the world begins to understand that Israel is an apartheid regime. And so I think we just need to understand, to sort of elongate what our conceptions of power and change are.
Thank you, Tare, for your thorough response. Yara, there is a. I'd like to ask you a question that received the most votes. And given that you are on the ground in Ramallah and that you have been there for many years, and you have been there during the Intifada, and you have seen firsthand what the PA and authorities in Palestine are capable of, can you expand? Here's the question: can you expand on the way or the ways in which these conflicted narratives between grassroots and between the grassroots and the Palestinian leadership level affects the broader access to the grassroots narrative? Does it impede it? How are we as advocates to deal with it in our own work?
I think that's a really important question because there is a disconnect between the narrative of the Palestinian leadership and that of the Palestinian street and the Palestinian grassroots. And the Palestinian leadership, or let's call it the Palestinian Authority, they work very hard at suppressing this narrative. We only have to look at what happened the summer following the political assassination of activist Nazar Banat, when protesters in Ramallah were calling for the fall of the regime and were calling for the resignation of the president. They were badly beaten. Journalists had their phones taken from them. Activists were arrested, detained. People who posted on social media were harassed and detained. So there is a very concerted effort to suppress this alternative narrative. And this alternative narrative questions the Palestinian leadership. It questions its position, its legitimacy, the fact that it is not democratically elected, the fact that it is propped up by the donor community and by Western regimes to maintain the status quo and to really contain and maintain the Palestinians. And so that narrative is not one that is attractive for the Palestinian Authority because it questions their very position, but it's also not one that's attractive for the international and donor community, who has found a very pliable, very willing partner in the Palestinian Authority. So I do think that disconnect is one of the main tensions that Palestinians are having to deal with. But I think there are lots of different tensions within the Palestinian narrative. You know, we aren't hegemonic. We don't all think the same thing. Even within the Palestinian grassroots, there are many differences and different narratives and ideas for the future. But I think one of the things, and I keep going back to the Unity Intifada because I think it was such a pivotal moment, was this recognition that Palestinians are united in their struggle against Israeli settler colonialism, and that they face the same struggle. It has different manifestations in different geographies. And so Palestinians in the Naqab might be facing, you know, different mechanisms, different ways of ethnic cleansing, of forced displacement than maybe Palestinians in the Galilee. But at the end of the day, this all comes under the same regime, the same umbrella of oppression. And so within those differences, I think that a singular narrative, a united narrative rather, can be found, one that demands liberation, one that demands a revolutionary leadership, not a sellout leadership, which is the one that we have now.
Yara, thank you. There's two questions that deal with something that is very fundamental to the narrative shift, and frankly, I can't decide who to ask this to, so I'm going to start with Tare, and then actually perhaps even hear about your opinion on this, Yara, as well. Two sort of related questions are about social media and their role, and particularly Instagram and TikTok, in forging and promoting this narrative, but also youth more specifically, and youth activism, since it's been since youth have really been spearheading the sort of social media campaigns that we've been seeing, at least insofar as impacting the narrative. One of our guests mentioned that this movement seems chaotic. It seems disorganized. To what extent a question that I'm coming up with based on these two comments is, to what extent can this youth, and this youth seems so fleeting these days in whatever ideas and energies they have, but to what extent can this be mobilized into something perhaps a little bit more organized, a little bit more standardized across social platforms, across global platforms, if it were to stay within the sort of youthful sphere?
So I'm neither a big user of social media, nor do I put myself in the youth category, so I don't feel like I'm the right person to answer this question, but I am going to put some thoughts out and sort of build on what Yara was saying when she was talking about the narrative sort of a leadership that's able to hold the different constituencies, one of the things that I was thinking about was that the narrative, in some ways, the movement, even beyond the narrative, has to be able to hold all Palestinians in the lowest common denominator, but for that denominator to also meet the basic requirements of what the Palestinian people are seeking, so that there is a diversity of views within the movement and that the movement is wide and inclusive enough to hold that diversity of views, but at the same time to be committed to a single goal. And I think that's quite hard to sort of think about. Those successful movements like the ANC in South Africa were able to do that, so that someone who's secular and someone who's religious can, for example, in the Palestinian movement, find a place for themselves in the movement, but still both of them, despite different ideologies and political backgrounds, are still committed to the same goal. And I think one of the things that the Palestinian leadership today has done that's problematic is that in their quest for a state, supposedly, have excluded segments of the Palestinian people, including Palestinian citizens of Israel and including refugees to a large extent, which is all really we need to know to sort of highlight the fact that that narrative is defunct, which brings us to the point of youth. I think that the Palestinians who are growing up now are understanding and seeing very clearly the deficits of the Oslo paradigm and are understanding that their rights were broken off in different parts to make that paradigm fit. And so they're coming to political age in a world that's calling for justice and that's calling for social justice, but also political and economic justice in ways that are opening up boundaries in how they think about Palestine. Just to give one example, when we're thinking about Palestine, and I started this the question just before by talking about the long-term the struggle. The long-term struggle cannot be divorced from climate change. How do we think about Palestine in the future, in the next 50 years, without thinking about climate change? How does that change the way we think about liberation? And so the youth are the people who are growing up in this world and who are impacted by that and who are thinking about these bigger questions and starting to forge the way forward in terms of creating imaginaries and future possibilities that we might not think of today. And so in that sense, I think it's really important for us to let the constituency that's coming up now lead the way in terms of answering what these questions are and in terms of showing us a different kind of imaginary. And I think social media, of course, plays a huge role in that. I wouldn't overestimate that. It's the same as saying, you know, the Tahrir Square revolutions were Twitter revolutions. They weren't. There were structural realities there that were facilitated by social media. But social media plays an important role in mobilizing, in connecting, in forging these narratives. The one other point that I want to say is that, of course, the movement is chaotic and disorganized. What movement isn't? All movements are chaotic. They're all disorganized. They are meant to be diverse and explore different areas and push in different buttons and move and adapt with the political context that they're growing in. At some point, yes, there needs to be a strategic direction and there needs to be a political decision-making body that that will emerge out of that movement. But I think the fact that it's disorganized, I don't think that that's a weakness in the movement. I think it actually shows its strength and its diversity.
Yara, please, if you have anything.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't have a huge amount to add, but I would like to just dwell on that final point about this perception of chaos and disorganization. And I would actually question whether that's the case. And maybe to certain audiences, it might appear that way because we don't have clipboards, but, you know, instead we're raging at demonstrations. And I don't think that reflects necessarily a movement or a group of young people who are not connected, who are not organized, who are not speaking to each other. I think there's different levels of organization. And I would ask this of the audience, you know, do you think that the fact that there were so many young people sharing a common narrative, putting forward really, you know, strong media talking points that were all shared and that were all, you know, incredibly on the same wavelength, do they think that that just happened by coincidence? The point is that Palestinians are organizing And this has been going on for decades. Whether that's visible to the international audience or not is not really, I don't think it's that important. I think the proof is in the pudding, and the fact that we saw groups of young people and old people and everyone in between come from different villages and towns across colonized Palestine to stand in shared struggle with each other. You know, there were literally buses of people, coaches, going to demonstrations, going to Sheikh Jarrah, sitting with families who are about to be, imminently displaced. The same is going on currently in the Nakba. I don't think that is disorganization. I think that is steadfast resistance to ongoing fragmentation. And to be honest, I think it's incredibly impressive, something that we haven't seen for a really long time.
Thank you so much to both of you. I wanted to go back before we close to a sort of institutional aspect to the discussion. So this question is again to both of you, and it actually links to the question that received the most votes, which is how can Palestinians circumvent their forced fragmentation to craft an inclusive narrative that represents the varied realities of Palestinians within Palestine and in exile. And I just want to say that this is a fundamental mission of Al-Shabaka. As a policy-oriented think tank, we really try to create a platform for Palestinian voices transnationally, not just within Palestine, and to sort of circumvent the forced fragmentation and so on. So to the extent both of you playing such central and key roles in the organization, and being so connected to other organizations that do similar work, I ask that question: how do we craft, through policy or otherwise, or through alliances with other organizations, how do we craft the narrative, or the content that continues to promote this narrative, whether in the political sphere or otherwise, but certainly in the policy sphere, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't direct this at anyone, but Yara, please go ahead.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work to do, and I do think it's an uphill struggle. This is not certainly not an easy world to work in, and is a hostile one to the Palestinian narrative. But I do think it's worth pursuing, because I think narrative can have material consequences. I think it can play into the realities on the ground, and going back to Edward Said's seminal article, Permission to Narrate, you know, part of the reason that the Israeli regime is able to keep doing what it's doing to Palestinians is to do with narrative. It's dehumanized us to such an extent and legitimized their own existence that many people have bought that. But I think importantly, and quite crucially, and this is something that Tarek pointed out, is that this can't stand alone, this kind of work. Policy, advocacy, academia, all has to go hand in hand with real grassroots organizing and a shift in power, as Tarek also mentioned. You know, it's not enough to produce a policy paper. It's not enough to do a webinar like we're doing now. We Palestinians need to build a new power base. And this is a massive project. And it's not the role of, certainly not the role of a Shabaka to create a new Palestinian leadership or to mobilize the grassroots. But I do think organizations like a Shabaka, their role is to create spaces for Palestinians to share ideas about their sovereignty, about their future, and also to combat our fragmentation. Palestinians are a diasporic people. 50% of the Palestinian people live outside of Palestine. And for many of us in Palestine, our connection with Palestinians outside of Palestine has been limited for so long. And the advent of various different communication technologies has meant that that's no longer the case. We now have online platforms where we can, as Palestinians, share ideas, be in touch with each other. And I think that is incredibly important and incredibly crucial in the Palestinian struggle moving forward.
You have been listening to Nadeem Pawasa, Tariq Bakhoni, and Yara Harawi speaking at a policy forum sponsored by the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Shabaka. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or at KKRN.org at 8 p.m. Sunday evenings. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.